solo and independent artist Seth Davey is beating the antidote for a chat. Seth, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be back, Dave.
Do you realize that you and I last met over a decade ago for a talk about the music of Atlas?
Was it after Into the Sea? Was it before that? Do you remember?
Yeah, we were getting into the music of Into the Sea album.
Okay.
Well, the crazy part is that turned out to be the last release from Atlas.
Yeah.
But now I've never heard the story of how it came to an end.
Well, there's a story for you, Dave, how much time you got. But let me just give my perspective on it. I won't speak on behalf of anyone else because we all have our reasons and all that. I would say it ended differently for different people. A few of the guys continued on for a few months after I left the band, and then it sort of fell through. My reason for leaving, so I had just gotten married, and my wife had a full-time job as a co-manager at Loft. I was still working for my father's ministry doing production and writing. But I've been praying for years, really. Lord, if you want to open the door for music, if you want us to travel, if like I'll be a musicianary, you know, I'll do that. I didn't really like touring. Another guy in the band, Evan King, phenomenal musician, he and I both shared this in common where we really just love to compose the music. And I loved meeting people at concerts. I loved worshiping the Lord and seeing that communal aspect of the live show and, you know, sweating and jumping over keyboards. And all that was a joy once we got to the venue, got to talk with people. But I was happy in life to, you know, not be on the road. So when Into the Sea was coming out, one of the other members in our band, he decided to leave the band. Our guitarist, John Sierra, he's doing his own thing in Nashville right now. Kind of took a hiatus a little bit, didn't really let people know what was going on because there was all this kind of up and down stuff. So we'd almost finished Into the Sea, but had run out of money. So we couldn't master it. We didn't have money to pay for all that. But In Vogue reached out to us. They got their lawyers and formulated a contract. And one of the specifications in the contract was that we need to be touring a week out of every month, which is pretty reasonable, as you know, Dave, for, you know, musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Soon after that, my wife got pregnant with our first son, Micah. Came out of the blue for us. I was like, okay, Lord, we're going to be parents now. My wife then stepped down from her co-management position, which means that I really couldn't just have the Starbucks job and just work part-time and write music. I had this big decision I had to make. And I'll just say this, Dave, for about a year in this time, you know, doors are beginning to open for us. I mean, we weren't a huge band by any means, but we got to go to Germany and play there for Christmas Rock Night, got to do some mini tours. And at the time, I was the only married guy in the band and definitely the only guy who was about to have a kid. And so, love my brothers to death, but we meet with them and they're like, hey, let's hit the road. Like, the door's opening. Let's go for it. And I was just, you know, struggling with, now I've got a wife who's given up her job and she's about to have a baby and I need to, you know, take care of my family.
Right.
All that to say, during that time, we ended with In Vogue. We ended that contract, but Face Down, Jason, a great guy from Face Down Records, he heard our music. He kind of saw the plight we were in. He understood where I was. They loved their music. And so they decided to sign us. And it was just a great deal because it was a great situation. It's the door that God opened. So we took it and praise God we did. We got signed and then starting to go different places, have different shows. And that's just when once Micah was born and my wife had a little bit of postpartum depression as well. And now she's at home. It was just a lot of like fraying, just a lot of being pulled in two different directions. It was almost a year of just straining before the Lord. Lord, what do you want me to do? What's the right thing to do? I met with the guys in the band. And I'll never forget sitting, looking across the table as we were trying to talk about the next steps and they were trying to be patient with me. And I remember Evan, I remember him saying something simple. It was like, Seth, you know, God's giving you different skills, a lot of talents. You're coaching, you're teaching, you're doing this over here. And he said, music is my one thing that I can do. And I just want to keep going. And right now in my life, I just feel like the Lord's calling me. You just keep going, carry this towards you, keep going further. And I remember when he said that, it was just, that's when God gave me this aha moment. For me, I was like, I don't want to hold these guys back. It hurts a little bit if Atlas goes on without me in it. It kind of feels a little strange, but at the same time, it was just clear that God was calling him to move forward. And I felt that that was just the moment where I was able to reconcile, I think God's calling me to step out. So that was my ending of the band.
Well, that was back in the old days, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
The music of Atlas was rock, you know, sometimes soft and often it was on the hard side. But what you're doing now barely even edges into rock. So now you got to tell me the truth. Did your wife tell you it was time to quit the loud stuff?
It was actually my mom. No, I'm kidding. No, you know, oh man, I don't know, Dave, if you knew, and this is very not well known. When I left Atlas, I put out an album pretty quickly, and it was just bare bones. It was me and a Yamaha grand piano. I just wrote some songs pretty quickly. It was an album called Till You're All I See, and it was a very transparent kind of lament, Asaph, psalm, lament type of worship album. Very bare bones, almost no editing at all. Kind of the antithesis of what Atlas was. Into the Sea was thought out for almost 2 years, and we kind of fought over all the chords and all the words, and everything was just this kind of collaborative monster that I think, by the grace of God, we just made something beautiful together. When I got out of that, I did feel some disenchantment and some detachment, and I remember sitting out at an old upright piano, like I used to do before the band, and just play and write and play for fun. I remember I was just starting to write songs, and I felt almost as if it was God just putting his hand on my shoulder and just saying, Seth, just play. It was almost a childlike moment where I felt like, hey, you know what? Collaboration is an awesome thing, but it doesn't have to be perfect. It never will be perfect. If the Lord can accept this offering, as broken as it is, as out of tune as this piano is, as rough as my voice is, then that just gave me a sense of freedom.
That debut solo, Till You're All I See. Now, it's cool that you gave me your two latest albums, but you didn't give me a copy of that one. It did have some winning songs, including one that you've actually repeated and brought out in a fresh version, The Highs and Lows. That song must have meant something special to you.
That is actually a great question, Dave. The Highs and Lows was inspired by my late great grandmother. She's with Jesus now. She suffered immensely in her life. She was legally blind, mostly blind. I'd go to her little house, I'd open her screen door, and I'd walk in, and she had this recliner. And I have the recliner still to this day that I use in my room to work, because it means that much. But she'd be sitting in her recliner, and she'd have this thick Bible. I mean, the letters on the Bible were, you know, massive. And she had a magnifying glass. And I just remember going into her house, and she'd have, you know, her magnifying glass, you know, pressed next to the Bible, just agonizingly going letter by letter by letter.
Oh,
and
boy.
She'd hear me come in. She'd put the Bible down, give it the biggest smile, put her arms out and say, Seth, come give me a big bear hug. And then she'd ask about my day and let me talk about all the middle school and high school stuff and college stuff. She spent her last years in hospice care scribbling out letters day for people at the church. You could barely read the letters. I have them all saved to this day. I'm trying to cry. I've got all her letters saved because she hardly had anything left. She had, you know, toes amputated, fingers amputated just from her diseases, but she wrote letters to people. So anyway, but I'll never forget her saying to me, she was uneducated, just a woman of the earth and a woman of faith. But she said to me one day, she said, Seth, some days I feel like God has abandoned me. And other days I feel like I'm his only child. And I thought, I was studying philosophy at the time. I read a lot of guys. No one will ever sum up the life and the Christian experience any more succinctly than my grandmother just did with that line. That's the lines that start off that song, The Highs and Lows. Some days I feel abandoned. Others I feel like I'm your only child. Some days my faith walks wounded. Others it laughs as it runs and runs for miles. That is why that song specifically is so precious to me. That's a great call out to bring up that song, because I'm going to carry that song with me to heaven.
That's great, because it is a truly personal, close song to your heart. In 2024, Seth Davey released Kingdom Rising. And now, if listeners haven't already figured it out, your songs are very Christ-centered. They're even worshipful at times, even if it is in a sort of alt-folk style. You've gone from the rock into this. This is the stuff that's really expanded your musicality, what you're doing now.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Dave. Give you another anecdote quickly. I was writing a fantasy novel in college. It was going to be one of five books, and I finished it. But then I just hit a delete button and just destroyed the thing, sadly. And that's why I went to do a master's degree. I said, you know what? I don't understand the world enough, geography, history, to write a great story. I want to go do that. But I say that to say this. I remember my dad saying to me at that time, I was writing this book, but I said to him, because I loved Lewis, obviously Tolkien, those guys, George MacDonald. But I remember saying to my dad when I started writing this book, Dad, I'm not going to write an allegory. I'm not going to do another Narnia. Guess what came out?
An allegory.
Yeah, a very obvious Christian allegory. And every writer's different. It doesn't mean better at all or worse. I just cannot get around that. As soon as I begin to write, I've written a few love songs. I've written, you know, I could write some country music, but I just lose interest almost immediately. But almost in a Davidic kind of way, or like Asaph I bring up, or Habakkuk, sometimes it is like a diary in your life where I'll go to a piano. God will put a piano in my path. And maybe I'm despondent. I'm far from God in the moment. I've walked away from him for a week or 2 weeks. And I'll sit down at the piano and God uses it as a conduit for me to get some of that out. And then like David in the Psalms, in my own way of you're kind of crying out, you're asking these questions, and the Lord through his grace brings it back around. By the end of it, you're like Psalm 42, why are you downcast, O my soul? Hope in God. It tends to start there. I'm sure you in your own life of faith, Dave, have many conduits like this. But for me, it really was that piano, an old upright piano, and God would put a piano in just different places. In college, there was a room in college. When I was in Wales and I got really dark there, I was doing my first master's in Wales and there was a lot of atheism. Just I was in a low, dark place. Sure enough, I found myself in this old building and there was an old room with a piano inside, and God used that to draw my faith back up. So I just cannot get away from the worshipful element or the devotional element. That's just what inspires me when I sit down to write.
Well, here's an example of one of your songs that gives tribute to God. In the Hearts of the Small says, oh, the thunderings of Marx and the lightnings of Freud, the hurricane winds Nietzsche hurled into the void. But I've heard not a word through their stormy defiance, like the whisper of God that I hear in the silence. That's something that's difficult for some to accept, the quietness of God. Do you think that God whispers to you?
Yeah, I think that's why conduit might be the wrong word, the most precise word, but that's kind of what I mean. It is a sense of like how grace works. I'll give you one example to answer your question. So I went back to Wales. My now wife had broken up with me. My grandmother I just mentioned had just died a miserable death. So I'd been home for 2 months from Wales, and I kind of been rock solid for the 6 months. I was an evangelist. I was preaching the gospel. I was walking with the Lord in a lonely place. I was letting a lot of that darkness get to me. I just remember a moment where I had the Bible in my hand. I just couldn't mentally get past all of the seeming contradictions or all the stuff that people nowadays are just, you know, deconstructing their faith over, sadly. But in that moment, I wouldn't have called it that. In that moment, I remember just dropping my Bible to my bedside. And it's just one moment that's emblematic of other times in our lives. I think we all have our own versions of this. I remember dropping the Bible to my bedside and just feeling like, I just don't have the energy anymore, to try to strain through this and work through it. Why is it so hard? And I felt like in that moment, I was like giving God up. I was just letting go. I just felt God just reach down as if even though I'd let him go in the moment, he was still holding on to me. And through that week, by his grace, he brought me around. Through a lot of other painful things, you know, I think by his grace, came out stronger. That whisper, that's why I say I go to a piano that all of a sudden ends up there. And what do you know? It's at a time where I've just been letting things build up and build up. And I've become disillusioned, or I haven't been reading my Bible. I haven't been praying. And I find myself there. And then through that, as I begin to play, all of a sudden the soul begins to, you know, kind of get some of that stuff out before the Lord. And then I realize, at the end of it, it's like this kind of this thread that just keeps coming and coming, and you get to the bottom of it and find out like what the heart of that internal turmoil is. How God like brings back a song. A song is light at times. For me, I can be in the dark. I can go to a piano and play a song in a time where God should be far gone for me. But for some reason, he just comes back and he lifts me back up.
You've mentioned about playing the piano a number of times, but there's more than piano on your albums. What about the rest of the instrumentation? How does that come about?
That's a great question. I work with a guy named Andrew McLeod. He started a label studio called Reckless Records. He's just a brilliant guy. He's one of those annoying jack of all trades guys who picks up an instrument and he's kind of a master at it already. But an an amazing friend to have. And our collaboration, it's a cool story how God brought him along, because I was in Winston-Salem at a studio recording Kingdom Rising and ran out of money pretty quickly. It's a very professional studio and very expensive. I didn't really know where to go. And this guy, Andrew, I had known him 10 years ago because my farewell show with Atlas was his very first Christian rock concert he'd ever been to. And so he was impressed. Yeah, exactly. He was writing songs. He had a band. He was a pianist. So he's watching, you know, me just do the piano thing and go crazy. And so I got to be, you know, what Blindside was for me, I got to be for him. Well, anyway, 10 years later, I was back on Instagram saying, hey guys, I'm working on an album. And he writes and says, hey Seth, let's get some lunch. Let's catch up on life. And sure enough, at that lunch, I had just been moving on from Winston-Salem, didn't know what to do with music. And as I brought that up to him, he's like, dude, I've got a studio. I'm producing now. I'd love to help you out and work with you and do that. And I was like, whoa, you know, just an awesome guy. So getting to get my feet wet with composing violin and cello, it kind of started out with me just writing the parts on piano. I write all the instruments with kind of piano in mind. And so that can turn people off. And I understand that. I even write drums percussively, kind of in a piano type way. So drummers have mocked me for that as well. but yeah, so getting to write drums, and we'll kind of start with MIDI. We'll frame it out with MIDI, and then we'll get a drummer, a guy named Henry, worked with him. Awesome drummer. Andrew actually played drums on Kingdom Rising. He's a drummer as well. But just getting to compose the parts, Andrew did some composition. He wrote some guitar parts. So I've got my own kind of little home studio. I've got my keyboard, can do the MIDI stuff. I'll write strings on MIDI now. I try to get other violinists and celloists involved as much as possible. I try to use the MIDI as just like your sketch, and Bingo. Then to have all the hands on. But sometimes, you know, sometimes the money is thin, or I don't have the relationships with the people to do that. And so we'll just use what we've got in the end.
The lyrics of several of the songs on Kingdom Rising bring in the word seed, and that also comes in on the title track. At one point, the song says, a seed is lost in anonymity. Beneath the ground, it fades from view. A cold world moves on apathetically, but love will change it too. You ever thought about yourself as being a seed that's being used to spread God's word?
Yeah. Dave, that's a powerful thought. Because we're in imitation of Christ. So any analogy that we put forward, or that Christ put the mustard seed analogy forward, which was it's just overwhelming how much is in that. And I've only seen an infinitesimal part of it, but just that little glimpse was like walking through a wardrobe and coming out the other side into a great big world. The more I delved into that analogy, the more clear it became and the more involved it became. So yes, I think it's incredible to use the analogy of Christ is the sower who sows himself as the seed, but that we are also seeds that he's germinating into his kingdom work, that he shares his glory with us, that he participates with us. Speaking of collaboration, that he collaborates somehow. I don't understand it, but that the Spirit of God would choose to collaborate with you, Dave, and with me, that he would use these weak, deficient hands. Whatever I craft is not worthy of him, and he could have done it way better without me. But he sows that into my heart to then be a vessel to bear fruit into other people, to then sow further seeds. Yeah. How much did I think about that? Did I think about that analogy? Did I think of myself as a seed? Did I think of the marvel, the mystery of Christ? Some, but now you've got me thinking, and this is good. Praise the Lord for that.
I think you and I should get into your latest album, Words in the Wounds. You brought in a new recording of a song that came out on your debut, but this time, instead of being called 30 years, now it's 39 years and counting. Are you feeling your age?
I'm feeling my age, Dave. Well, the funny thing is, the project I had in mind a year ago was called Hymns in Hindsight, and I was going to take 5 of those songs from Till You're All I See, just change them and make them more triumphant and more major sounding, and ran out of money, and then Hurricane Helene hit right as I was trying to raise some funds. And I was like, I just lost all energy for the music. I said, I need to give some money to that endeavor. And then that morphed into Words in the Wounds. To put a period on that, the funny thing is that, a year and a half ago, I was 38. So I put out a demo version of the song, but it was called 38 Years and Counting. Then sat on that for a while. Then once I was doing Words in the Wounds, it's like, well, I'm 39 now. I can't sing 38 Years and Counting. So some of the fans who were with me during that time continued to mock me for the fact that I just keep changing the name of the title of the song based on my age. When I finally have a concert next month, Lord willing, at 40, I'll have to sing 40 Years and Counting.
Oh, 40 years, man, you're on the downward spiral.
I think it goes up from here, Dave. You're proof of that. It goes up, onward and upward.
The reason I really go for that song is because I can relate to it, not just the age part. It says, you are not fooled. You yeah. see how pitiful my heart is, but you keep loving me regardless, and I am the fool, because I see how beautiful your love is. So why do I keep loving you like this after 39 years and counting? You know what the real question is why don't we change?
Yeah, Dave, it's I think the amazing thing is, as you know, we change for the better, but it's almost like medicine. You get an illness and you take a medicine that helps with the symptoms of your illness, but gives you another something you didn't have before. It's got a side effect. I feel like being a father of kids, it's like, in many ways, thanks be to God, I'm much more patient in certain situations, much more selfless. I have to be to survive and to learn how to love these little kids. But on the other hand, I'm also worse than I was when I was 30 and 25. And I don't know why that is. It's like you grow stronger. Maybe you're different, Dave, but for me, it's like I grow stronger in certain weakened areas, but then other areas, I learn more about myself. I'm more selfish than I thought I was, you know, or I just, you know, as time goes on, there's more areas of conflict, and it kind of brings out like other types of ugliness. Maybe I've overcome this lust over here that was with me for a while, praise be to God, but now there's anger issues, you know, towards a loved one or towards a friend. You know what I'm saying, David? It's like words. You see yourself rising, but also still falling. And we're falling, as Psalm 37 says, David says, I'm young. I was once old. I've never seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging bread. Though his feet may slip, he will not fall because the Lord upholds him in his hand. And that's why a song like that, I think, is precious, because it is a diary kind of song. It's a song I need to be singing from generation to generation as long as I'm here, as a reminder that, Lord, you're still with me.
Well, that's the thing that I find with songs like that, Seth. It's like you open up your soul for everyone to look inside of it.
Yeah.
But do you leave it open enough for listeners to accept what you're really aiming for?
And do you mean by that, Dave, that maybe people will listen and misinterpret it, or maybe it's too raw and they won't see the silver lining of the grace of God?
Exactly.
I think it's a great question, but I will say, like, when I read Habakkuk crying out to God, what's the deal? And the Assyrians are coming in, these wicked people, and wiping out your people. When I see David in a cave, like I said, Psalm 42, crying out to God, or Lord, I remember the days of old, the days when people used to come to the tabernacle, used to sing songs, and now it's all dried up. And I think that there's a precedent that God has inspired for us through the lives of our predecessors and through the psalm writers and the prophets, where much of their approach to God is crying out to the Lord. What did Jesus say? Jesus, who empathizes, now this is what the wounds are about, God who empathizes with the depths of our suffering, what is it he says in the cross? Father, why have you forsaken me? Because it's the definitive cry of our human condition. So I think it's necessary, Dave, that we're not all going to write the same way, or we're not going to be called to do the same thing. I'm not a positive, encouraging kind of guy. What encourages me is to see Job in an ash heap when he's lost everything, but he's not cussing God out. He's not throwing in the towel, but he is saying, Lord, will you please, you know, give an answer? Help me to understand this. And God does. I've got a friend who I work with who says, Seth, why can't you just write like happy-go-lucky music? And like, I listen to your songs, and there's always that moment where I feel like it gets a little dark. You're going through shadows again. And I was like, I get it, man. I'll try to, but it's not what moves me when I read. It's not how the Lord has drawn me out of those pits myself.
And that's the kind of music that I go for too.
Oh, awesome, Dave.
Let me bring in another one. When I saw the song title, Glorious Disgrace, I thought, Now, there's a strange oxymoron. And the lyrics say, "It's hard to face this, but when I see your face, I see what grace is. Such a glorious disgrace." You got to help me out here. How can disgrace ever be considered glorious?
I know you know the answer, Dave, so I'm kidding. You know what? I got to be honest. I got to show my hand a little bit here. When I wrote that song, I believe I was talking to a friend, and in like pop Christian culture, there were some songs that like it used a word like God is reckless, or like reckless love, or he's reckless abandon. When that was becoming mainstream, and that word, and I talked to a buddy of mine who really loved this song and said like it really, it got him thinking. And for me, it was a little bit what you just described that my songs might be for people. I didn't think that reckless could really have a glorified meaning. It didn't seem like it could really be paradoxical. It seemed too anthropomorphic in a sense, that God becomes reckless in his love for us, that like he kind of fumbles the ball, or he's running down the football field. He kind of chucks it up and takes a dive. And
I have never imagined God running down the field with a football.
I have not until just this moment. But, you know, a quarterback is running back, looks up, and just kind of throws a bomb, and it gets caught. There's recklessness, and like you don't really know what's going to happen. There's a little bit of chance in it. It's a little risky. So I just personally don't like that word. It kind of inhibits me when I think of trying to understand the paradox of God's sovereignty and our free will and all that. Around that time is when I wrote a couple of songs, but Glorious Disgrace was one of them, because then I got to thinking, well, what is a word then? I think I see what we're kind of grasping at when we talk about Christ having reckless love. And so for me, I thought actually a paradox is the disgrace of it, that God disgraces himself when he's on his knees to wash Judas's feet. So like the whole life of Christ disgracing himself to be a man of sorrows with no face that we would admire, that is a paradox. To me, as a writer, I just think that parallelism, like the glorious disgrace, that he would empty himself, Philippians 2, to lift us up, mm-hmm. is God disgracing himself, but for our good. I don't think we have a word in English that says all of it, but what I thought that reckless love, for me personally, again, not casting judgment on other poets, to me, it didn't really put the paradox forward. It just put kind of like the human side of it and kind of anthropomorphized it too much, I thought. That's my two cents on that.
That's a good thought. We're getting almost to the end of the questions. Almost.
Yes! Have I passed the lie detector test, Dave?
You have. You know, as we've been talking, something I've really been curious about. How do you find the time to make music? You've mentioned being married and having kids, and there's got to be more to life. How do you find the time?
Oh, Dave, I've got to carve it out. I mean, I sacrifice other things. Sometimes I do sacrifice time with kids, and I have yet to find the balance. I'm not a regimented person. I'm a night owl. So when it comes to crafting these last two albums, especially Words in the Wounds, my wife and I have three kids. Mike is 10, Sky is 6, Mariah is 18 months, and by the grace of God, Megan is pregnant again. So with Words in the Wounds, we had a little baby. So I was up till 2:30 in the morning, from like midnight to 2, once I put my wife down and all the kids are obviously in bed. That's when I had the stamina to be able to write and compose, because that's when it was quiet. Mm-hmm. I work from home mostly as well, so I can go to work later. So thanks be to God for this season of life. I have more flexibility in my daily and weekly schedule. Into this year, one of my goals, I'm asking the Lord, how do I do all of it better? How do I give 100% to everything? How do I make more music and even get better at that and become more efficient in production and not get burned out and not become a grumpy dad at the end of the week who needs to sleep?
And not to have a wife that's going to choke you.
Exactly. Yeah. Fortunately, she's a lot shorter, so I can just stand on my tippy toes and she can't reach up. But it's a great question. I'm still trying to improve and making improvements. I'm more of a hack of a pianist. I don't consider myself a great pianist. But my son has a real gift. I play by ear. I compose. But I get to inspire him. It was amazing, Dave. After I put out Kingdom Rising, my son would go by ear and he'd sit down at the piano and just, I'd never asked him to do it, and just start playing my songs. He'd go, "Hey, Dad, I think I've got it now." And then he'd start to write his own songs. So it's like art inspires art. The fact that I can inspire my son, who will probably go on to do much, you know, much greater things, thanks be to God for that, through this, that is kind of a salve on the days when I feel like, Lord, am I wasting time? Am I spinning my wheels for nothing? Because I am getting to directly inspire my own kids to go further in their own pursuits.
You know, the cool part about that is that he's your son.
Yeah.
He's there at home. He can do all the piano for the next album and you don't have to pay him anything.
How dare you, Dave? How dare you? No, that's funny. Yeah, he's going to come to me one day and go, "Dad, are you ready for me to take over? You just stop doing that thing what you do with the keys. Just let me do it."
You and I should be talking about the title track from Words in the Wounds. Lord, in our grief, when we get hit from left to right with no relief, and all our hope gets swallowed up in disbelief, and when our prayer is a bitter cry through gritted teeth, oh, still you hold us fast. That really seems to be the focus of the album. We struggle and fail, but God stays with us.
Yeah. I appreciate you pulling out those lines in particular. And again, you already got this, but Words in the Wounds is a play on words. There's more than one meaning to that. But really, I got to preach a message to the college students that we help to serve on Sunday mornings with that, the picture of when I brought Psalm 37 up, when David says that when we fall, we collapse into the hands of God. It struck me that these aren't just all powerful hands. These are wounded hands. These are hands that are calloused hands. Hands of a man who cried out our deepest yearning, "Father, why have you forsaken me?" That is where it all culminates. That's the crescendo. That's the minor to the major lift thematically of each song of our lives of faith when we realize we aren't crying out to a ceiling. We aren't crying out even to some deistic God who's has all the power, but he's like way up there somewhere. We're in a long line, you and me, Dave. When all of a sudden we realize even the words I'm crying out and straining out, even Jacob wrestling with God, and when it's not so nice, those are written in his wounds. It's enveloped. It's immersed in the passion of our Lord, who also somehow can empathize with that darkest side of our humanity that in our moment of grief feels like God has abandoned us. How can God empathize with that? Well, we don't know, but we see the wounds that our Savior wears for all eternity. We hear his cry from the cross, and we rest in the fact that he understands that. So I just think sometimes, like someone mentioned to me recently, "Seth, I appreciate your vulnerability in music," or "I appreciate kind of the authenticity," or you're not afraid to hide the flub voice stuff, whatever. And I start to think about vulnerability. I'm like, well, why is that? Like, why am I driven to that? Yeah, I think as a precedent for us as artists, as men of God, as fathers, as husbands, we should be like the seed that you brought up. We should be imitating Christ as well so in that vulnerability as best we can. Yeah.
You're so right. Well, listen, Seth, I got to say, I love what you're doing. Keep it going. And thanks so much for this talk.
Thank you so much, Dave. It is absolutely a pleasure to get back with you after 10 years away. hope for many more.